620 WGN.
Hello, everyone, and happy Father's Day. Happy Father's Day to the fathers and the stepfathers, the fathers-in-law, the mothers who father, the grandfathers, the uncles. Did I miss anyone here? But anyway, I hope it's a wonderful day for you. Hope it's a special day for you. And for those of you who have lost your father, like I have, I hope it's a day of happy memories and fond recollections. I certainly have them. And what I thought I'd do in this first half hour is to take your phone calls, and I want to hear from you. What is the best advice your dad ever gave you? What's the best advice, or what did you really learn from your father? Either one, because sometimes the words don't mean as much as the actions, and I certainly think that was the case in my family. It's not that he imparted words of wisdom as much as just his actions showed me so many things about life that I've carried through until now. Let me give out the numbers. They're a little bit different now than they were last couple weeks. 312-591-7200, or text me, 312-591-7200. What is the best advice your father ever gave you? We are going to do this probably through the 7:30 time slot, and then we're going to be talking a little bit about parental alienation, and we've touched on it before in this show, and it's the alienation of children from their parents, and we have an expert on that who's going to be talking a little bit about that. On a day like today, people who are not speaking to their children are sad, and we want to acknowledge those people and maybe give some advice as to those things. Then, at 8 o'clock, as usual, we are going to be taking your calls on any legal topics at all, any legal topics. So get ready with those calls, 312-591-7200. I thought I'd talk a little bit about my dad. My dad was a very interesting guy. He was a child actor. He went out to Hollywood when he was very young, and he did the screen test, and he performed in a movie called East of the River with John Garfield, where he played John Garfield as a young man. And he then did Dead End Kids, which were the precursors to the Bowery Boys, and he did a series of those serial films, which were very cool, and he was a little tough guy from New York. And after that, when he went away to the war, he performed throughout his tenure in the military in Special Forces, where he entertained the troops all over the world, and then he came back when he was out of the Army, did stand-up. He was a tap dancer, a world-class tap dancer, and he opened Playboy clubs for Hugh Hefner across the country, and basically his whole life was a stand-up comic. So he had a very, very interesting career, and many times he was on WGN, which I find very, very interesting because here I am on WGN, and he never lived to see me on WGN, but I assume that he would be proud if he were alive. So best advice my dad gave me, I think, and Jerry, I'm going to have you weigh in as well, but and also Roger and Cash, but I think that my dad taught me how to be treated as a woman. I think that he really spoiled me, not monetarily, because there wasn't a whole lot of that going around, but I think, he really showed me how to be special, that I was special. He put me on a pedestal. He did special things with me. He was very creative. He was very funny. He listened to what I had to say. He indulged my curiosity and basically encouraged me in almost everything that I ever did. And, I guess there's a quote that I read on the internet, something like, a daughter needs a dad to be the standard against which she will judge all men. That was Gregory Lang, whoever that is. But that's a great quote because it's true. It's really hard for me to be around people who aren't good to me because I had such a good dad who really took care of that role. Jerry, what did you learn from your dad?
My dad used to tell me all the time because I was one of those little smart-ass kids who always had an answer for everything. And he always said, you need to learn to listen more and talk less. He'd always quote that, I believe it's Abraham Lincoln, who said, keep quiet and appear to be a fool. Open your mouth and remove all doubt.
That's great. That's great. Your dad, the strong, silent type. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's nice. Let's go to Ron. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi.
What's Happy Father's Day to you?
Yeah, thank you. I lost my dad about 20 years ago, but I have great memories. And he always said, never give up. Don't have regrets. Always take a few chances. Don't play it safe all the time.
And did he not play it safe during his life? Did he do some risky things that...
Well, he meant, career-wise, take a few chances. Don't just, try to climb the ladder or be your own boss or do whatever you need to. Yeah, he did great, and I definitely took his advice and think I've done decent in my life. So
great. Well, thank you so much, Ron. Thank you for the call.
You have a great show, by the way.
Thank you so much. Have a great Father's Day. That was nice. There's a texter who said, let's see. He said, I lost my father last Father's Day, so it'll be a year ago tomorrow. Oh, he was a wonderful man. He taught me many great lessons. But I think the best lesson that my dad taught me was that you really don't ever know what goes on in someone else's house. So you can never judge. And that has helped me tremendously in my life. And my family is thinking about him today and will think about him tomorrow. Thank you. Oh, that's nice. Never judge. That's good. That's always good advice. Roger, what was the best advice your dad ever gave you?
Well, just like you were saying before, dads tend to be less verbal and more, do as I do, don't do as I say, kind of. And it was an unusual situation in our family. I'm the youngest of three. And I wasn't exactly planned. So,
Oh, are we all, are any of us planned?
Well, I mean, really? It's, but when the family has a boy and a girl, some families say, we've got one of each and that's it.
Actually, my father, we had three kids in the family, and he used to say, I have three kids, one of each. And everyone would look at him, and no one could figure that out anyway.
And you said that he also worked at Playboy clubs. And
he did.
If he was working in the early 70s and came through Chicago, I might have bumped into him.
You probably did.
I was working at Playboy in the hotel, but I hung out over at the club when the comedians up in the showroom.
Roger, you and the bunnies.
Well, we won't get into that.
But actually, for those of you who don't remember the Playboy clubs or never went there, they were really classy places. I mean, people think of it as a strip club, but I mean, they were very nice. And my father worked very clean. He was not, and you couldn't go in there, really. Maybe toward the end, in the late 70s, maybe you worked a little blue. But back then, it was a pretty clean place, and there were rules about not fraternizing with the bunnies, treating everyone respectfully, and it was a very nice place.
Yeah, it was, and they had a ton of rules. But the things my dad taught me were by what he did. It was to work hard. It was to be fair, to be honest, to always give 100%, to never come up with excuses. That what you had to do in life is what you had to do in life, no matter what it was. The only thing he verbally told me was never get into insurance. He was a lifelong insurance agent with Metropolitan Life and did very well by it. But of course, not that I purposely went against what he said, but I eventually actually did work in his office up in Highland Park with him for about a year, actually as a life insurance agent.
Well, I suppose your parents always want to save you from the struggles that they went through. And my father always told me, get a real job. Don't do this kind of stuff because, it's fun, it's great, and I love my life. But, you really want to make a living. And I think being a lawyer, at least, you're guaranteed. Or you're not guaranteed, but it's a pretty safe job to get a job and to make decent amount of money, put food on your table on a regular basis, which we all like. But thank you for sharing, Roger.
Sure.
And we're going to take a break. And if you have any more Father's Day words of wisdom, give us a call here. Otherwise, we're going to talk about some legal topics of the day, 312-591-7200. That's actually not a real happy song for Father's Day, is it? All he left me was alone. Ugh. I chose it, Cash. It wasn't your fault. It was me. A texter says, I always tell my siblings, your parents do the best they can raising you. I guarantee most times you'll hate them for it. The circle of life. Yes. And there was a great quote. Clarence Darrow said, I'm going to paraphrase it. He said something like, the first half of your life you spend thinking your parents ruined it, and you spend the last half of your life thinking your children ruined it. I don't know if that's true. That's kind of funny, but it's not very positive. You know, I'm not a big World Cup follower here. I know that there are people who are just crazed by what's going on. I know, Jerry, you love your soccer. But I just read this morning. Did anyone hear this? The World Cup celebrations may have caused an earthquake in Mexico City. Well, Mexico City is always having earthquakes. I think last time we were there, there was an earthquake just before and just after. But apparently Mexico beat Germany by 1-0. I guess that was a huge upset. And it was today at about 11:32 a.m., and there was an earthquake right at the same time that the Mexican team scored a goal, and they think that it was the jumping up and down of so many people that it actually caused what they call an earthquake, like an artificial earthquake of a small magnitude. Isn't that interesting? Really, really, really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about... I'm no Kim Kardashian fan. I've never watched her do anything. I don't know what she does. I know she makes a lot of money. I know who she's married to. But I was very interested in this story this week. President Trump commuted the sentence of a woman named Alice Johnson. She was a first-time drug offender. She got a life sentence. She had already served 21 years. She was a great-grandmother. A series of events in her life caused her to kind of go down the drain. She had 5 children. She got divorced. Her son died in a horrible motorcycle accident, and she got into some drugs, and it was bad. Not violent, but she did do the crime, and she was doing the time. And while she was in prison, she did all kinds of good things and became a minister and helped other people and did all those good things that people can do when they're in prison. And interestingly, Kim Kardashian somehow saw this on Twitter in a feed she was following, and she became involved with the lawyers, and she made a call to Jared Kushner and to Ivanka Trump and said, can I have an audience with your dad? I want to talk to him about this pardon or commutation. And she did, and she went to the White House, and we saw that, and she sat with him, and Donald Trump commuted the sentence of Alice Johnson basically based upon his conversation with Kim Kardashian. And at first I was skeptical. I guess I was like, what is everyone's agenda here? Because it just seems so strange. I've never seen Kim Kardashian do anything politically astute. I've never seen her do anything significant. And I don't mean this in a bad way, but I know she spends her time doing her show. And I never thought of her as a social activist, put it this way. I also know that Kanye West, her husband, has said some things that are very in favor of Trump. And I know that she has said a few things that haven't been. So interesting that she was able to affect this. And I watched, there was a show where she was interviewed, and I was very surprised that I really think that what she did was based upon her her conscience. And she said, if I have all these followers and if I have all this fame, if you will, she was very nice about it. And she said, I saw this woman and it was wrong that she's spending this much time. And I know that I know people that I can get to, Donald Trump. And I knew that if I could do it, why not do it? I was very impressed. And again, I'm not naive, and I know people do things for a reason, but I just wondered what you all thought about that. If you want to weigh in, 591-7200. Jerry, I know you have a different view of this than I do.
Yeah, I really do. Of course, I'm always the most cynical person on planet Earth. First of all, I wish I had their money. Second of all, I think her mother is the brains behind the whole family. I think the rest of the family's combined IQ is probably 11.
Oh,
did I say that on the air? Also, you know, she's
all the way to
Kanye
the bank,
West, who may be a fabulous musician, but just has no clue when to keep his mouth shut. She's pushing 40 years old, and this is what happened. Her agency, her mom, her public relations ratings probably aren't that great. So her PR company got together and said, wow, let's make you a humanitarian. You should do something altruistic. And
that's so cynical.
Yeah, it is. And Donald Trump, only reason Donald Trump met with her so that he could free this African-American woman and maybe pick up some African-American votes on the next election.
Well, yeah, you know,
a bad taste in my mouth.
And that's plausible. And I think I may have been on your side on that one. But when I heard her speak, I really did. I mean, to the extent that she's genuine, to the extent that she's sincere, I think there's certain times that people, maybe being a mother, I think she's got three children, you know, maybe at some point she says, I've got all this wealth, I've got all this fame for doing really nothing in particular. And she saw a way to use that fame and use those connections to make the phone call that nobody else could. And one of our texters says, Ivanka got that done, a Democrat and daddy's little girl. And so I think that I really believe she did that for the right reasons. And as much as I'm not a big Donald Trump fan, I think that commutation was appropriate. I think it was a good thing to do. I think she's the person that you want to commute the sentence, nonviolent. She's made her peace. She's done her due diligence in jail to be a better person. And I like giving people a second chance. So I think that story ended up being a pretty good one for me. Anyway, give us a call here if you have any comments, 312-591-7200. This is Karen Conti on Father's Day on WGN.
There's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand.
Welcome back. It's Karen Conti here on WGN. Happy Father's Day to everybody. Well, Father's Day is usually a happy time, and I don't want to be Debbie Downer here. Sometimes it can be a sad day for parents who are alienated from their children, meaning they don't get to see them. Parental alienation is a syndrome that affects thousands of parents and children, both mothers and fathers, and it destroys not only the parent, but eventually the children. This is a very interesting topic for me and one that's near and dear to my heart as I see it in my practice in family law, and I see it destroying families all over. And here to discuss the topic of parental alienation is expert Jill Agisi, founder and president of a parental alienation awareness organization and herself an alienated parent. Hi, Jill. How are you?
I'm great, Karen. How are you doing?
Thanks for taking time today to do this. Let's just define, what is parental alienation for those of our listeners who don't know?
So there's, you know, there's a lot of sort of psychological ways to say it, but in layman's terms, simply put, parental alienation is when one parent turns the children or child against the other parent and his or her family, usually appearing in a high conflict divorce, but worked on cases where estranged from a child due to his or her own bad treatment of the child, has sort of a wait and see attitude. So on the other end, they're not like an alienated parent who would do anything that they could do to make time or to have time with that child who is then being alienated from them. The estranged parent doesn't pursue a relationship with the child because in their mind, the child is the one responsible for mending that relationship. And the estranged parent will find it hard or almost impossible in some cases to view the situation from the child's perspective. So they don't see their own behavior as playing a role in the problem, and they feel entitled to behave badly with no repercussion.
If anybody has any questions or comments about this, if you know somebody who is going through this or you yourself is going through this, give us a call here. Jill, I'm sure we'll be happy to address your questions. 312-591-7200 or text to that same number, 591-7200. I just want to talk a little bit before we take a break as to why would a parent do this? What would drive a parent to badmouth the other parent? We all know that both parents should be involved in a child's life. We all know that a child generally loves both their parents. Why would a parent do this?
Well, there's a few reasons. So the first one would be there's a need to get, when there's a breakup, there's a need to get emotional justice for whatever that alienator perceives the other parent did to them or or didn't do for them in the marriage. So they want to make them pay, and they know that the only way they can do that is by trying to take their things, take their money, and then destroy a relationship with a child. That's the almost sort of the coup. You know, take the child, and you've done everything you can do to break the heart of that parent and his or her family, because we have to remember the tentacles of this do not stop at the alienated parent. They outreach to the entire family, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. So emotional justice is one reason. Another reason could be that they hadn't even thought about it, but they go out and they look for, and I'm putting a big red arrow above your head right now, they look for the best attorney that can take them to court and get what's due to them. So they may not even understand the concept of parental alienation, but many lawyers amp up the fight, the conflict, so that, why? Because this is a middle to upper class, upper white class, thing that happens. And so when they're in the courtroom amping everything up and getting everybody going and keeping the conflict going, what happens? Checks are written. So the money keeps coming, and ultimately the alienating parent runs out of money because most times the alienator is the one who's got the money to make it happen. And when the money runs out, that alienating parent gives up.
And I think that so much of what you're saying is true, and I'm going to add to it that the law helps the alienator, because what you do, you know, when you file a divorce petition to get divorced from your spouse, you say, I'm a fit parent, and maybe you say he's not a fit parent. That's a standard allegation. Even though it may not be true, you say it anyway because, you know, I stopped doing this years ago just because it's the wrong thing to do. It sets people at odds right away. It makes a battle out of something that should not be a battle. It should be a cooperative process to keep the kids safe and happy during a really bad time in their life. But the law helps that along, and the judges help it along too, for the most part.
They absolutely do, and I always say, why would you want to go in and allow a family court to sever your relationship with an ex when you could just simply get it over with a handshake? If you're not invested, here's the thing that really bothers me, Karen, is when people walk into family court and they think that it's good, every justice and truth is going to prevail. That's the furthest thing from the truth. You have to walk in invested in what's going to happen to your future and the future of your children. You do not want, even though my brother is one of the best family court judges that I know, you don't want someone that's going to see a snapshot of you for 15 minutes or even an hour making a decision about what's going to happen to you and your family for the rest of your life.
Absolutely. Jill, can you hold with us? We'll take a break, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit about the Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt case.
Great.
And that case was in the news just quickly. There was so much other stuff going on, like world peace and all kinds of things. But I want to talk about that using it as an example. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Thank you for the music and your stories of the road. I thank you for the freedom when it came my time to go. Kindness and the times when you got tough. And Papa, I don't think I said I love you near enough.
Welcome back. It's Karen Conti on a Father's Day. That song gets me all teared up. We're talking to Jill Ajizi about parental alienation, which is basically the parents who brainwash their children against the other parent. Jill, thanks again for joining us. I want to use a little story that came in the news as a springboard to talk about this topic. We don't know all the facts between Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, and I'm not sure I care, but it was an interesting news report that came out that where the judge issued a ruling that said something to the effect that not having a relationship with the father is bad, and that if things don't change, there would be consequences for Jolie, meaning if the minor children remain closed down to their father, and depending on the circumstances, it may result in a reduction of time they spend with Jolie and may result in the court ordering primary physical custody to Pitt. So we're kind of reading between the lines here, but what I'm thinking is happening is that, according to this judge at least, Angelina Jolie, who's got custody of these kids and has made some allegations about Brad Pitt's fitness to be a father, which didn't really rise to any level while they were together, but since they're being divorced, apparently he now is a terrible father for one reason or another, and the judge is noting that, and the judge is saying, Jolie, if you don't let these kids have access to their dad, talk on the phone, see them, and encourage a relationship, I'm going to switch custody. Does that sound like what's going on to you?
Well, that's exactly what's going on, I believe, and something that needs to happen even more than it does. These high-profile cases where it happens, I mean, it would be great if Brad Pitt would actually speak out a little more and bring some attention to what is happening with parental alienation, because it really is an epidemic all across our nation and around the world. It's not just in the United States, but in many, many countries. So what's happening here, this judge felt strong enough to step up and give her these parameters saying, look, if you don't do this, then you won't see your children. And I think judges are inevitably conservative in their orders because they don't want blood on their hands. You know, a lot of lawyers will come forward and say, well, these kids threaten to commit suicide or run away from home if you take them from their mother or their father, because this is not a gender issue. This happens equally to men and women all across our country, from California to Maine. So even when the evidence is overwhelming that alienation is occurring, courts may still end up saying these parents are to make joint decisions about the child's welfare when it's very clear that this would be impossible to do. So by admonishing Angelina Jolie and saying, look, you need to toe the line, you need to foster a relationship with Brad Pitt for these children, because that's what's the best thing for these children, is to have a relationship with both of you.
And switching custody is a drastic situation, because these kids are totally bonded to the parent who,
right,
and they don't want to be with the target parent because their mom has made him out to be an ogre, but that's in some cases the only way to extricate the children from this horrible syndrome. And you're right, judges don't like to do it because it's ugly.
And you don't hear, I mean, it does happen. You don't hear about it very often. And I think the last big case that was in the news was in New York, and there was one in Toronto before that. It just doesn't happen very often. And I think as we see the old guard judges sort of moving out, the older gentlemen that have been there for a very long time and have retired, you're seeing Brian Ludmer and I speak to bar associations, and we're seeing at these seminars that there are young judges like my brother coming in their late 30s, early 40s, and young women. They all have small children. They recognize the parental bond, and they see that it's a very important thing to create a mature individual that's going to be a real meaningful contributor to society when they grow up, because these alienated children are damaged goods.
They are, and it may not manifest until later, but at some point these children realize that they listened to a parent who was lying to them or brainwashing them, and on the other hand, they were horrible to a parent who probably didn't do any of those things, like not pay child support, not want to see them, treat them horribly. So they are in this horrible conflict that the two people they love most in life, they've screwed with one, and they listen to the other who is lying. So this really makes it difficult. And as you know, the statistics show that there's a huge amount of damage that can be very permanent.
Very permanent. Just a few things that can happen to these kids. There are trust issues, loss of self-esteem, the inability to have a relationship, because after all, they've been taught by the alienating parent that disposing of one of the most important relationships in your life is okay. You can throw it away. Doesn't matter. Everything is disposable. Move on. Try to do what you can with what you've got.
Jill,
and you don't need your mom or your dad. It's okay.
Let's just really quickly tell what should parents do. Tell on a Father's Day, you know, you don't like him. Maybe you divorced him and he's a jerk and you don't like him. What should you do? What should all parents do to encourage that relationship? What are some examples?
Well, you know, I want to tell you, today I saw a post, Father's Day to today for me is that. Usually it's Mother's Day I'm sad on, but Father's Day today, I lost my dad 3 months ago, and
yeah,
so it's
I'm
been
sorry.
A long day for me, and my children not recognizing that death, and my father knowing until he died that he hadn't seen his grandchildren for 15 years was very sad. But I saw a post of a gentleman who has a father's rights group, and he said, "My wife said to me today, 'Happy Father's Day,' hell must have frozen over." And I thought to myself, I wonder if she sees your post on Facebook, because the answer to that would have been, "Thank you. I appreciate you saying that."
Right.
But I think that there's so much animosity after this whole parental alienation thing rears its ugly head that you almost don't know how to respond. And presentation is 150% of this. If you behave like the alienator is making you out to be, then what are people going to think of you? They must believe her. They must believe him, because you're manifesting all of those behaviors. So alienated parents have to sort of walk on eggshells, wear a halo 100% of the time. When I'm working with people, I tell them, don't go to bars, don't post on Facebook, don't lament over your, don't air your dirty laundry, in other words, on social media. Try to have contact. If you're at the mild or moderate level and you still have the ability to have contact with your children, never ever give up.
Never ever give up is the best.
That's the mantra of the whole world, but you don't want to overdo it. If you call too much, you're harassing. If you don't call enough, you don't care. So there's a fine line there. I mean, you want to try to maintain the level of connection that you would have if you were in an intact marriage with these kids. And I think the other thing that people don't realize is so many parents that have kids who are growing into the teenage years, I mean, these teenagers today don't want to spend time with you when you're in an intact marriage. So you've got to realize that your time would be less anyway, because they want to be with their friends. They want to be out doing what they're doing.
Jill,
families aren't like when you and I grew up. It's
Jill,
different now.
I'm going to need to break here, and I'm going to get your contact information. If anybody needs a reference to an organization or wants to talk to Jill about this, I will have that contact information on the other side. I'm going to be taking your legal calls next. Jill, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Karen.
All right. You're listening to WGN. It's the Karen Conti Show. This is the time of the show you can get your legal questions answered. I'm a practicing lawyer. I've been doing it for 31 years. And you can call us here, and I'll try to point you in the right direction or give you a good answer. 312-591-7200. That's a different phone number than has been in the past. I think it's just temporary because we're moving out, as we all know, of this beautiful Tribune Tower. 312-591-7200, or text to that same number. If for some reason you don't get through, or you would rather talk in private, I understand that, you can always call me at the office and we can have a quick chat about your legal issue. 312-332-7800. And better yet, it's good to email me, because then you can give me the facts, you can give me where it happened, where you live, what you need, when it happened, and what your expectations are. Concise summary would be great. And that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com. And that's KarenConti. wgn@askkarenconti.com. But now the number, 312-591-7200. A texter earlier at the very beginning of the show had a simple text that said, "Can you sue the FBI?" And that's kind of a big question. Generally speaking, it's very difficult to sue a government entity, whether it's the police in a local setting, a school, or the FBI, a federal entity. And it dates back to what we call sovereign immunity, which is the day of the king and the monarch, and you weren't able to sue the king because he was superior and you wanted to keep him free of lawsuits or civil liability. So those things kind of trickle down throughout the years from England and into our American jurisprudence. That's a big word. And so basically it's hard, but there are ways that you can, and there are reasons that you can. First of all, if you're asking about FBI, let's just say an FBI agent is rushing to the office or rushing to a an event, and he hits you with his car. You can sue the FBI for that, because that FBI agent is acting as in the course of his work, first of all, and he's acting as a normal citizen, meaning he's going to his job or he's going from his job or he's doing something for his work. So you can sue the FBI. But when we're talking about suing the FBI for wrongful prosecution or wrongful incarceration or wrongful interrogation, those are very, very difficult things to do, because you would have to prove more than just negligence. You would have to prove that the FBI was doing something intentional that caused you serious harm. And so those cases are very difficult. Occasionally you'll see the ACLU sue the FBI as a class action for maybe them doing taking tactics that are violative of the Constitution. But again, those are very, very difficult cases to bring, and they're very difficult cases to win. I also got a text this week. I know we're still talking about whether Blagojevich is going to be, his sentence going to be commuted by President Trump. And it was an interesting text questioning, what do you think Blagojevich is going to do? Will he run for office? Will he practice law? And one of the things that you should know is, interestingly, if you are a convicted felon, you can run for office in Illinois, and you can run for a federal office like U.S. Senator. But you cannot run for office in Chicago. Isn't that interesting? You would think it would be the opposite, but that's what the law is. Convicted felons, no in Illinois or the United States, but yes, I mean in Illinois and federal, but not in Chicago. Also, Blagojevich, I'm not sure that he had his law license revoked, but I think he did not renew it. And when you are a felon, generally speaking, the organization in Chicago, in Illinois, that licenses lawyers will take your law license away, because if you're convicted of something that is dishonest or violative of the law, then you're determined not able to practice law. And although he didn't get disbarred technically, I believe he just let his license lapse, and if he tried to re-up it, he probably would not get that license back. And a commutation wouldn't address that and wouldn't erase that felony, so he probably is not going to practice law. A lot of people think that lawyers can maybe go to work as a paralegal, but there's a law in Illinois that says that a convicted felon or someone who's been disbarred cannot work in a law office, because the temptation is too great for that lawyer to actually practice law rather than just be a paralegal. I don't know. What is he going to do? Is he going to get a microphone somewhere in this day and age? I don't know. Is he going to write a book? Absolutely. It would surprise me if he's not working on that as we speak, and might write a book and try to make some money that way. And I'm sure that his family has friends in high places who might help him out with selling real estate or something like that. But again, we will see that. We'll see that when it happens. Again, phone lines are open, 312-591-7200. Any legal questions you might have, family law, criminal law, probate, estate planning, neighborhood disputes, breach of contract, small claims, credit, a bankruptcy. Actually, I get asked this a lot. When should I file for bankruptcy? When is it a good idea to file for bankruptcy? And generally speaking, I say you should get a very good consultation with a very reputable bankruptcy lawyer before you file. And the reason is because bankruptcy has some long-lasting effects. And although it does give you a fresh start because it gets rid of your debts, you do lose things. So you lose personal property, and if you have a lawsuit pending, you have to give that up. If you have a house, you may get to keep a portion of it, you may not. Certainly some of your personal property, if it has any value, has to be given up in a bankruptcy. So there's also the issue of dischargeability, which means what debts do you actually get rid of in a bankruptcy? And some of the things that you don't get rid of are taxes, which is usually a big part of someone's debt portfolio, if you will. State and local do not get discharged ever. Student loans never get discharged. Child support probably won't be discharged in bankruptcy. So you have to be careful, because if you file for bankruptcy and those debts are still outstanding, you know, you're still going to have to pay them back. So you may not want to do that. But definitely get a consultation if you need a reference to a bankruptcy lawyer. I can do that for you. And you would probably just want to send me an email, wgn@AskKarenConti.com, and tell me where you are, and hopefully I can hook you up with somebody who can give you a good answer. Again, let me give out the numbers, 312-591-7200. We're taking all your legal questions or any question you have that you saw in the news this week about a news story that you want to discuss. I'm happy to talk about them. Taking your calls right now. Give us a call, 312-591-7200. A texter says, answer this, Karen, why haven't credit card companies passed along some of that 20% tax break permanent onto the consumer? That's not a question I can answer, because it doesn't really require a legal answer. I think it's really just maybe it hasn't trickled down yet. Or maybe they're not going to pass it on. Maybe they're going to take that and increase their profit line. I suppose whenever there's a tax break, your hope is that there's going to be a pass along to the consumer, and that's some of the reasons that our government passes those tax breaks, but that doesn't always happen. Doesn't always happen. Jerry, you had a question that I think we were driving back from Wisconsin, and you something was on the news. What was it?
Yeah, I heard something on the radio that the state of Kentucky is suing Walgreens for having too many opioids.
Yes, yes.
I mean, doesn't Walgreens just fill prescriptions that are filled up by doctors? What's that about?
Yes, I did see that, and I did a little bit of research on it. Yes, Walgreens, they're saying that Walgreens was over-marketing opioid-based painkillers. And, you know, obviously Walgreens is Deerfield-based, so it's of interest to us here. But they're saying that they excessively distributed opioids and failed to legally report the suspiciously large orders. I'm really kind of astounded by this case, because the statistics say that between 2006 and 2015, Kentucky gave out more prescriptions for opioids than there were people in the state. And it has a very, very high death rate from opioid addiction. So, but even though I see this as a serious problem, I guess I don't understand how Walgreens could possibly be liable. Walgreens fills prescriptions. Now, who's prescribing the opioids? Doctors, right? Doctors are prescribing. So I could see suing the doctors and saying you're overprescribing. I could see saying doctors should be sued because they're not monitoring the use of those opioids once they are prescribed. And I could even see suing the manufacturers who are making these drugs, knowing how very addictive they are. But the idea that Walgreens has any liability just doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't know, unless there's something I don't know, I don't see why they would have any obligation whatsoever to report that there's more prescriptions for these things. It just doesn't make any sense to me at all. So anyway, JJ, welcome to WGN. Do you have a legal question? Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hey, Jay. How are you?
Good. Happy Father's Day to you, if that's appropriate.
Yep, thank you.
Okay.
The question I have is regarding estate planning, living will, that kind of stuff. At what stage or how much asset do you need if you have that you should be doing that planning?
Okay. Well, I think everyone should have an estate plan, and that doesn't necessarily mean a formal trust or a formal will, but you need to understand what you have and how it's going to be passed on with the least amount of trouble, with the least amount of expense possible. So there's no set number where I say you should go see a lawyer, but let's just say that you have a house, and that's really all you have, and maybe you put the bank accounts that you have in the name of your son, and you have one son, and he's going to get the house, but you still want to make sure that it happens very simply. And what happens a lot of times is parents will say, oh, the kids are just going to get it, and they'll do it, and they'll divvy it up, but they don't provide for the passage of title, and they don't provide for those things the right way. I would say that everyone needs to talk to a lawyer briefly about what they need And some lawyers will give you that free consultation and tell you one way or the other if you need a will or a trust or an estate plan, or they might just help you put those assets in joint tenancy with somebody else who upon your death then would get those assets. So if you want to email me quickly what you have, just generally speaking, I have a house worth $100,000, I have a retirement account, I have a savings account, and you tell me that and I will forward that to a lawyer who I know who can maybe give you an answer. Okay?
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to give out my contact information again, and that's WGN at AskKarenConti.com, or you can call me at 312-332-7800. And again, the number here tonight is 312-591-7200. Let's go to Terry. Hi, Terry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Karen. Thank you. I am calling to find out, this is for family law, is there an expiration on a judgment?
Okay, that's a good question. Okay. Is it a judgment for child support?
Yeah, it was for daycare and insurance and medical bills.
Okay.
And I have a judgment for $15,000.
How long ago did you get that judgment, Terry?
Well, I got it back in, I think it was 2008.
Okay.
And why? Why I've waited this long? Because my daughter, actually, and was very upset.
I understand. All right, Terry, let me give you a quick answer to this. Okay, I'm going to put you on hold. Yes, a judgment is generally good for 10 years. Okay, so you said 2008. We're in 2018, so you need to look at the date of that judgment and make sure that you're still within that time. And if you're not, you might be out of luck. If you want to extend it, you can extend it. There's a way to extend a judgment, but you should get into court right away to try to enforce this. $15,000 is a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money in the legal system, so maybe you garnish wages, maybe he's got a house that you can put a lien on very quickly, but I would contact a collection lawyer immediately to see if the judgment is still good and what you can do about collecting it. I understand why people wait, because they don't want to cause conflict with the family. Totally get that. I understand it, but you need to act quickly. Send me an email and I'll get you in the right direction. WGN at AskKarenConti.com. I'm taking your legal calls, 312-591-7200. I hope you're having a wonderful Father's Day. We're going to take a break and we'll come back with more legal questions. This is Karen Conti on WGN.
Thank you. Thank you. I want no shenanigans in my courtroom. Please bring on the first case.
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. I'm taking your calls on any topic at all. Any topic you want to talk about, I'm happy to talk. 312-591-7200. We've got Katie, Margaret, and Julie on the line. I'm going to get to all of you. Let's start with Margaret. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Karen. I love your program.
Oh, thank you.
I missed your background statements that may have been regarding the person who was whose sentence was commutated by President Trump.
Yes.
I guess my question and comments regarding that, you know, we often hear about nonviolent offenders who are, you know, put on house arrest or whatever. Now, on another program, I had heard the background of this woman. She was not just a minor person who dealt with drugs. She sounded like she was a major kingpin type person that was dealing in multi-million dollar selling of drugs, not only in our country but in other countries. So I guess my concern is, you know, not just with her case. You know, it's nice if somebody's reformed when they're in prison, but when I think of a nonviolent offender, I don't think of somebody who's doing something that causes perhaps other people who are trying to get the money to buy the drugs. They're hurting innocent people, they're killing people, they're robbing people, they're disrupt other people's lives, and yet that person that's causing the other people to commit those crimes, they might be getting off relatively light when other people's lives, innocent people's lives have been destroyed.
I think you make a very good point. I don't pretend to know exactly what she was charged with and what she was convicted of, but to get a sentence for life for a first-time nonviolent drug offense, she would have to have been selling huge amounts, because this was a federal crime, and the federal laws, when it comes to sentencing, basically it's driven by how much money is at stake, so that there's all different factors that the judge considers, but one of them is just that: how much money was at stake? And to get to that level, given her situation, it must have been millions of dollars. You're right. And you're right to say that there may not have been violence in what she did, but certainly when you deal with the drug trade and drug traffic, there are victims all over the place, people who overdose, people who try to get the drugs, people who are selling it on the street and who are attacked. And, you know, as we know, the gangs are distributing a lot of this stuff, and the gangs are violent. So I think that's a good point, and I understand where you're coming from. And there's probably a lot of people, you're right, who have, you know, gotten better and done their penance in jail and see the light. And not everyone is going to be commuted or pardoned. But I guess I would have to say this one, I don't know, I guess I don't feel too badly about letting her out. I don't feel like our world is going to be any less safe. But
yeah, Karen?
Yes.
I could just make another comment. Yeah, I guess, you know, we are starting to hear this term nonviolent offenders so often now. Our own president of Cook County, Tony Preckwinkle, keeps saying, well, you know, we're not going to keep people incarcerated if they can't come up with the bail, if they're nonviolent offenders. But again, you know, I think we're starting to throw that term around too much. And to me, and I think a lot of other people, that's why we're so afraid now to go any place, whether it's to a shopping center, walk down the street or anything, because we keep hearing about people who are hurt by these people, and then they're out within a short period of time. And nonviolent, you know, I'm thinking of somebody who steals a sandwich from someplace because they're starving. That's nonviolent. But somebody who carjacks somebody else.
Well, and that's violent. I would put carjacking at violent. But thank you so much for the call. I think that's really a good point. On the other hand, I do know that what Tony Preckwinkle, I think, is trying to do is that when you have a place like 26 in California that is truly overcrowded and people are in there longer than their crimes would allow because of the chaos and what's going on there, they are letting people out who are violent. And we've seen this over and over again, people who have had illegal gun possession and have had gun charges who are being let out. So to me, and I guess this is not as simplistic as I'm going to make it sound, but we should triage this. We should keep the people in there who are the violent offenders, who are using guns, who are using illegal guns, and the rest of the people, we should figure something else out, whether that's some sort of work release or something where they can hopefully get back on track. And there are some good programs over there where they try to get people who are on drugs to get off the drugs. If they have people who are selling drugs because they can't get a job somewhere else, they try to rehab them. And so the courts have been very proactive in trying to help these people. But thank you for the call, Margaret. Let me go to Julie. Hi, Julie. Welcome to WGN. What's your legal question?
Hi. I have a lawyer that we hired because my parents had drew up the will. So, but anyways, they have something that is like in a title that we want to get the money back from. And I've tried calling the lawyer umpteen times, and she's been doing this for 3 years. And I've called her umpteen times, left her messages. She won't return a call. I don't know what to do.
The state has
written her a note saying, please send the paperwork. We're waiting for it. And I did talk to her once because she didn't know it was me. But then after I did talk to her, she won't call me back.
Okay, that's just really unspeakably bad. Lawyers.
Yeah.
But I hear that all the time. Lawyers don't return calls. I just don't understand that because it's a very simple thing to send someone an email or to call somebody or have their secretary call somebody back.
That's the trouble. It's only her in the office, and she claims that it's her husband, that she doesn't have enough time. And I said, well, can I at least pick up the paperwork?
So here's what I recommend, Katie. I would recommend writing her a letter or an email or both and just say, I've tried to call you, and name how many times, and say, I've been trying to get this from you. You're refusing to get back to me. I don't know what else to do. If I have to hire a lawyer, you know, I'm going to, you know, hold you accountable.
My brother has done that, and that's why he put me to it, because he's now out of country.
Okay. So, I'm going to put you on hold, but I just want to just give you the rest of the answer. People say they call all the time. Calling is one thing, but you need to put it in writing. In writing, everything. The dates, the times. And then the last resort, if you want to hire a lawyer to get that done, you need to do that. That's fine. There is the Illinois Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission, and that is an organization that licenses lawyers in Illinois, and you can make a complaint. You can file a complaint against a lawyer. You can go online, fill out the paperwork. I don't suggest that people do this as a way to get their lawyer to call them back. I really don't. I think that hopefully the lawyer will eventually call you back. But this sounds like it's risen to the level of something's wrong. I don't know if she's having trouble herself personally, but this is inexcusable not to call someone back and give them what they need. So hopefully you can resolve it that way. And if not, you can give me shoot me an email and let me know who the lawyer is. And maybe I know the lawyer. Maybe I can make a quick call. WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Thank you for the call. And we're going to get to the rest of your calls in the last 15 minutes. The number here is 312-591-7200 on this hot Father's Day.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law?
Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. We still have some time to give us a call here with any legal question or any question you have. 312-591-7200. If you don't get your call in, you can always call me at my office. Happy to talk to you. 312-332-7800. Although sometimes it's better to send me an email because then I can just get you the information more quickly. And that email address is WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Let's go to the lines. Hi, Rick. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi.
Hi. Do you have a legal question?
I got hospitals, when you have back surgery or any surgery and you end up getting an infection while you're at the hospital,
yes.
Are they
yes.
liable or, I mean,
okay.
I guess what's the person's options on that?
Okay. That's a good question. I get that question all the time. I'm not a medical malpractice lawyer, and that's the specialty, the area of concentration for a lawyer who does that kind of work. Generally speaking, an infection after surgery is a expected or a potential complication. And usually when you sign all that paperwork, you acknowledge that in the paperwork that an infection might happen, because that's what happens in hospitals and that's what happens when you have surgery. But that said, if you had a serious infection that caused you very serious problems, you might want to consult with a medical malpractice lawyer to look at it to see if there is such a case, because there is a standard of care that the hospital has to honor, and that is to determine if there is an infection. And sometimes hospitals and doctors don't do that quickly enough, and therefore the infection takes control and does some things that it shouldn't have done. But again, whenever you're dealing with malpractice, just understand that it's very very difficult to bring these cases. People think that no matter what happens, something happens that's wrong. In the doctor's office, you have a lawsuit. Their lawyers do not take these cases unless there is a lot of damage, meaning a lot of medical bills or permanent damage or death. And so they're very expensive to bring. You have to hire a lot of doctors and medical people to testify. And it's all very expensive. So even if something goes wrong in the hospital and you think you have a suit, I encourage you to talk to a lawyer. There's no reason not to, but don't be surprised if the lawyer doesn't take the case, because they take very few of these cases. But if you would like to, Rick, send me an email with the information about where you were treated and what happened to you. I can at least tell you where, if your statute of limitations is run, and refer you to a lawyer who might talk to you about the case and give you some advice in a little bit more detail. And that is WGN@AskKarenConti.com or 312-332-7800. Let's go to Barb. Hi, Barb. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Hi, Barb. Barb. Barb, are you there?
Mother was put in a nursing home in a couple of weeks ago. We asked for them to treat her, to test her for UTI. She was diagnosed positive and never treated. We removed her from the association place. And just wondering if there's anything we should do. We removed her, and she was in the hospital, and she was removed against medical advice.
I'm sorry. How was she removed from the hospital?
She was put in the nursing home because we were told she had so many problems she couldn't go back to her residence, and then she was put. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to hang up.
Okay. Well, let me just see if I can sort of answer that question. Failure to diagnose something, again, probably the same answer to the last caller, which is it's very difficult to bring these cases just because the nursing home failed to diagnose something or test her for it. We would have to prove, the lawyer who took your case would have to prove that there was great damage to your mother, like her condition got worse, and that because they didn't treat her and diagnose it right away, that she suffered some sort of harm that's permanent in nature or that caused her pain and suffering and those kinds of things. I don't know from those facts, and obviously, I mean, I'm not a medical malpractice lawyer, but if you wanted to give me a call at the office or send me an email, I'm happy to send it on to a lawyer who might want to talk to you about that and give you some further advice. There was a texter who asked me, are you familiar with squatter's rights? Some six people moved into a vacant property in the city of Chicago, and the city says they can't evict. So I'm not sure of all the facts here, but generally squatter, that term means somebody who comes into your property and adversely possesses it, which means they have ownership of it, and that is very difficult to do. If you went into a property, you'd have to be there at least 20 years. You'd have to pay property taxes for, I believe it's 7 years or so, and then you might have some ownership rights to that property. So this is not what we're talking about, a squatter. These are people who are occupying a vacant home or vacant building and maybe are causing trouble. I know that does happen in some neighborhoods in Chicago. The city can evict and will evict. Also, the owners of the property can be forced to deal with this issue, because I know there are people who will cause a lot of problems in this issue. But I think that you should perhaps, if you're interested, contact a lawyer who does housing work and see if you can get an answer and get these people out if it's something that's of concern to you. Anyway, I'm going to give out my numbers at the office, 312-332-7800 or WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Happy Father's Day to everybody.